1988 was a pivotal year for the Seventh-day Adventist Church. First, the church published what I believe was one of the most important books since John penned the Apocalypse on the island of Patmos centuries earlier. And that book was The Great Controversy. Secondly, at the Minneapolis General Conference session convened in 1888, and two upstart preachers kicked the legalistic Adventist hierarchy in the shins with the message of righteousness by faith, and we've kind of been hobbling along on that topic ever since. And finally, 1888 brought the slightly discomforting issue of Senate Bill number 2983, introduced by New Hampshire Senator H.W. Blair, and the bill was, quote, to secure to the people the enjoyment of the first day of the week, commonly known as the Lord's Day, and to promote its observance as a day of religious worship. In 1888, quite simply, Seventh-day Adventists faced a national Sunday law. It's hard, though, from our perspective, to see how this could have been anything other than a national Sunday law and not the big one, which we all have been anticipating. First, the bill wasn't a blanket across the country Sunday law, forcing everybody to close on Sunday. That's not what the bill was. The bill was simply something to enable the states to enact Sunday laws the way they wanted to do it. Okay, it was to protect Sunday laws in the states. That's all the bill was. It wasn't a blanket Sunday law. Secondly, with anti-Catholicism so virulent in America, it just was hard to understand how in 1888 the United States could, as Ellen White said, unite with the papacy in forcing the conscience and compelling men to honor the Sabbath. I mean, we live in a day and age now where there's, you know, after Second Vatican Council and all this goody-goody feelings, but I mean, maybe even some of you more mature, shall we say, Adventists might remember some of the days of just the virulent anti-Catholicism. And certainly none of you are going to remember it back then, but even what you might remember in the 20s and the 30s is nothing what it was back then. So it's just hard to see how they could have united back then. And finally, in 1888, it was just very difficult to see how the United States was in a political or military position to somehow enforce, you know, to cause the world to worship the beast, cause the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. Just hard to see how all those factors could have come together back then. I suppose they could have, and Ellen White certainly believed it could have, but from our perspective, it's somewhat difficult to see it. Nevertheless, even if these laws didn't lead to the mark of the beast, the last thing the church wanted or needed was any legislation which strengthened or encouraged Sunday laws in the states. All through the states, the United States, particularly in the South, Adventists had been arrested, fined, jailed, and really faced some pretty heavy persecution because of, you know, working on Sunday. Adventists had been arrested for painting churches, digging potatoes, cutting briars out of fences, plowing, hauling rails, cutting firewood. You know, one was even arrested for hunting squirrels. I wonder what he was doing with the squirrels after he hunted them. So, you know, really, the church was opposed to this Blair bill. And we know, of course, how in 1888, A.T. Jones went before the Senate and the House and argued against this bill. And there was a book out called The National Sunday Law, I guess, where Jones just published his argument and put it out. And, you know, in one sense, though, Jones had it easy. Because Bill number 2983, it's, the way it was originated, it was permeated with religious language. Its stated purpose was to promote, quote, the Lord's Day as, quote, a day of religious worship. It forbade secular labor. And the bill sought to enhance, quote, the religious observance of the Sabbath day. This aspect of the bill left it wide open to Jones's assault. And Jones went after it. The object of this bill, Jones said, is wholly religious. The last section shows the object of the entire bill, and that is to secure to the whole people rest and the religious observance of the Sabbath day. No one, therefore, need attempt to evade the force of objections against this bill by saying that it is not the religious but civil observance of the day that is required, because it is plainly declared in the bill that it is also to secure the religious observance of the Sabbath day. There is not a single reference in the bill to any such thing as the civil observance of the day. The word civil is not used in the bill. It is a religious bill wholly. The title of the bill declares that its object is to secure to the people the enjoyment of the Lord's Day as a day of rest and to promote its observance as a day of religious worship. That was, in a nutshell, the essence of Jones' argument. And the bill died. How much impact Jones had, I don't know. The bill died. And chances are it might have died even without Jones's testimony. See, at that time, you know, America was just involved in an incredible expansion. I mean, America was in the business. America's business was business, and America's business was making money. I mean, the country was growing phenomenally, and people were moving out west, and industry and farming and agriculture and mercantilism, everything was just growing and growing, and there was more and more resistance to anything that would stand in the way of people making money. And when Sunday laws were closing down businesses and just stopping people from working and making money, there was just a growing resentment to Sunday laws at that time, because people were just wanted to get out and hustle and make their money. So politics then, as much as theology, probably helped sink the Blair Amendment. But see, what was interesting too was, After this bill failed, those who wanted to push Sunday laws, they learned from it. They learned that let me read you a quote from Warren Johns. He was a lawyer at the GC. He wrote a book years ago on Dateline Sunday, and he talked about this. And he said, Sunday law proponents learned from these skirmishes. They learned that the stronger the religious rationale advanced for creating the establishment of a Sunday law, the stronger were the constitutional arguments available to opponents. Consequently, the reformers made an effort to cultivate the support of labor on the basis that a federal blue law would serve a public welfare and promote the interests of the laboring man. So in other words, basically what they're saying, look, let's get this religious language out of here. Let's get this Lord's Day stuff, and let's just promote Sunday as a day of public, what would be the word? Let me see what I have here. Just something to public welfare, just for the good of society, have a day of rest when businesses are closed down and people could be, you know, just taking a so totally secular rationale for Sunday laws. And by the mid to late 1800s, the secular rationale for Sunday laws was becoming a part of American law. And however oxymoronic the term, the secular Sunday was hatched. This idea of a secular Sunday law. And although basically right now, and I don't know what it's like around here, but in most of the country, the concept of blue laws themselves and Sunday laws themselves have all but gone the way of segregated toilets, The U.S. Supreme Court in 1961 handed down in one day four decisions that firmly established the constitutional rationale for Sunday laws. Whenever Sunday laws do return, if written correctly, they will have the constitutional protection of the courts. I mean, the Sunday law, it'd be very hard for me to imagine a Sunday law case, a secular Sunday law case now even making it to the Supreme Court. Because they have basically firmly in four cases established the rationale for it, and they have upheld Sunday laws, secular Sunday laws, as constitutional. Here's something from Associate Justice William Brennan. Listen carefully to what he's saying here. In the Sunday law cases, we found in state laws compelling a uniform day of rest from worldly labor, no violation of the Establishment Clause. The ground of our decision was that, granted Sunday laws were first enacted for religious ends, they were to continue in force for reasons wholly secular, namely to provide a universal day of rest and to ensure the health and tranquility of the community. In other words, government may have originally decreed a Sunday day of rest for the impermissible purpose of supporting religion, but abandon that purpose and retain the laws for the permissible purpose of furthering overwhelming secular ends. See the point? He's saying, in the beginning, sure, they were religious laws and this and that, it was unconstitutional, but now they have abandoned the religious purpose and are just promoting Sunday laws are okay for overwhelming secular ends. He says, even if Sunday laws retain certain religious vestiges, they are enforced today for the essentially secular objectives which cannot be achieved in modern society except by designating Sunday as a universal day of rest. Okay? That, in a nutshell, is the argument. And it's constitutional law. It's there. I mean, any Sunday laws that would come up now, they would go back and they would use these earlier decisions to justify, you know, and use that for their rationale for it. That's what they do. They make a decision, then years later they go back and use the decision to justify further decisions. That's how case law is built. Now, if Brennan's rationale there is not bad enough, in McGowan v. Maryland, which was one of those four cases, Chief Justice Earl Warren, you know, you've got the perfidious Mr. Liberal here, Earl Warren. Earl Warren himself used some rationale in McGowan v. Maryland that I think, and used a slice of history that I think is going to come back one day and haunt Seventh-day Adventists. And that rationale was that James Madison, the man who is called the father of the Constitution, the man who basically penned the Bill of Rights, including the First Amendment, James Madison once pushed a Sunday law bill through the Virginia legislature. And Earl Warren went back and used that to help defend the constitutionality of Sunday laws. He said, look, here's the founder of the Constitution, pushed a Sunday law through the Virginia legislature. You know, in other words, the man who worked to make these words into law, Congress shall make no law establishing, respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The man who pushed those into law also, not too much earlier, once pushed these words into law. If any person shall on Sunday shall himself be found laboring at his own or any other trade or calling, or shall employ his apprentices, servants, or slaves in labor, or other business, except it be in the ordinary household offices of daily necessity, or other work of necessity of charity, he shall forfeit the sum of 10 shillings for every such offense. That was James Madison. Now the story gets worse. James Madison didn't write the bill. He just pushed it through the legislature. Who do you think wrote that bill? Thomas Jefferson. Okay. Jefferson. Okay. The man. You know, again, one of the great geniuses behind the concept of religious freedom. He wrote the bill. About the same time that Thomas Jefferson wrote his famous, his groundbreaking bill for establishing religious freedom. This is the bill which was like one of the first times the principles of religious liberty were really firmly established in law. You know, the principles of this bill eventually came over to the First Amendment. In this bill which Jefferson wrote, he said that no man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall be enforced, restrained, molested, or burdened in his body or goods, nor shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions and beliefs, but that all men shall be free to profess and by argument to maintain their opinions in matter of religion, and that the same shall in no wise diminish, enlarge, or affect their civil capacities. From us, we say, what's the big deal? For back then, all you have to do someday is pick up and read some of the religious bills and religious laws that early Americans suffered under to realize how radical of a change this was, to say that people should be able to believe what they want and profess what they want and practice what they want and not be affected any way by civil penalties whatsoever, to be totally free. It was a radical concept. But at the same time, he wrote that bill, a bill for establishing religion. He also wrote and drafted the bill called, quote, a bill for punishing disturbers of religious worship and Sabbath breakers. That's what the bill was called, Sabbath breakers. You know, Sabbath is a religious term. You know, so the bill is nothing but religious. Jefferson didn't even attempt to try to couch the language of the bill, you know, in any kind of secular terms to get it passed. As I said, this whole concept of a secular Sunday really didn't get established for another century. And people noticed this. An article, actually it was in the North Carolina Law Review, by a constitutional scholar named Daniel Dreisbach. Well, I've actually had him write for Liberty before. The title of Bill number 84, he said, unequivocally states that this legislation was written to punish those who worked on the Sabbath day. The religious intent of the bill is undeniable, made obvious by the use of the word Sabbath as compared to a religiously neutral term like Sunday. In short, there is no indication that the sponsors of this legislation advanced the bill principally for a secular purpose. I think he's got a point. So Jefferson's bill basically authorized to the government to enforce the Sabbath, meaning, of course, Sunday, the exact thing that the principles of religious freedom, as expressed by church-state separation, which he helped found, are supposed to forbid. So the question you have is, you know, what is going on here? How do we reconcile this? Well, I really can't. I can give you a few arguments and a few things which I think might help us to understand what's going on better. Which, let's take a look at that for a minute. First of all, you need to understand a little bit of the background of what was going on here. After the colonies declared independence from Great Britain in 1776, legislatures in Virginia wanted to rewrite the statutes of Virginia, you know, harmonizing them more with the principles of republican government, you know, and expunging, you know, and stripping away as much as they deemed appropriate vestiges of the hated British monarchy. I mean, you know, Virginia was an Anglican state. You know, the Anglican Church was the Church of England. Well, now they were at war with England, and so they wanted just to rewrite the laws and have new law code. And the result was a revision of 126 state laws, of which Jefferson revised 46 of those laws. And I actually lent to the Library of Congress and just went out and got a copy, an old copy of those revisers, that code, and Xeroxed them and just, you know, have them on file. The result was a revision of 126 state laws. Jefferson revised 46 of the laws, including 3 of the 5 laws in Virginia that dealt with religion. Jefferson revised 3 of the 5. Now, nothing happened to the revisions until after the mid-80s, 1780s, a few years after the war with England ended. They were just too busy fighting the war with England to get things done. And at that time, Thomas Jefferson went over to France to be our ambassador to France, while James Madison, kind of his young protege, pushed most of these bills through the Virginia legislature, including Bill number 82, which was Jefferson's famous bill for establishing religious freedom. Jefferson was so proud of that bill that on his tombstone, he didn't even have the fact that he was the second or the third president of the United States. He had on there, among the other things, that he was the author of this bill for establishing religious freedom. And he should have been proud of it because it was a groundbreaker in the history of the whole, you know, modern world. So there was Bill number 82, his bill for, you know, punishing, bill for establishing religious freedom, and Bill number 84, a bill for punishing disturbers of religious worship and Sabbath breakers. Both these bills were enacted in 1786. So the question you have is, how could Thomas Jefferson, who with Bill number 82 helped establish the eternal principles of religious freedom, while at the same time advocate the punishment of Sabbath breakers? And how could James Madison, Madison was such a staunch separationist that Madison opposed chaplains for the military, and he even opposed tax breaks, you know, tax exemption for churches. How can Madison, who was such a strong separationist, you know, at the same time push the Sabbath breaker bill through the Virginia legislature? These actions don't bode well for those who believe that Sunday laws of any kind, much less something as religious as Bill number 84, you know, are compatible with the principles of religious freedom. Now again, I'm not a prophet, and I'm careful in making predictions, but I don't think you have to be a prophet to realize that whenever Sunday laws do return, this bit of history, this little bit of rationale will return with it. Well, what is the answer? Well, unfortunately, Madison and Jefferson, neither one of them, as far as we know, have ever wrote their sentiments or rationale about Bill number 84. So we don't know what was in their thinking. But the bill didn't come in a vacuum. Actually, Bill number 84 was a revision of an earlier Sunday law bill, one that I think went back to the early 1600s, which actually not only required attendance at divine worship, which Bill number 84 didn't do. All Bill number 84 did was forbid you to labor on, quote, the Sabbath. The earlier law not only forced attendance, but also outlawed travel on the, quote, Lord's Day, with the exception of going to and from church. So however egregious Bill number 84 might seem to us, it was a great improvement over its predecessor. See the point? So whatever it was, it may, you know, chances are Madison and Jefferson realized they could probably, whatever they thought about Sunday laws, they probably realized they could never do away with it completely. Not at that point, not with religion is that strong in there. So maybe they just thought, well, we can't do away with it, let's just tone it down a little bit, not make it as strict as it was. I mean, back then people did not understand the concepts of religious liberty the way we do. Believe me, we take the things we have for granted. We just assume, well, you know, because that's just all we have ever known. See, they couldn't even get the bill establishing religious freedom passed until the mid-1780s. They couldn't get it passed then. They couldn't even get that passed. So much less if they were going to try to abolish Sunday laws. It's very possible they just felt they couldn't do it given the political climate at the time. And at the same time, too, these men were politicians. They would compromise. I mean, politics is the art of compromise. They would play dirty politics. They would. Madison and Jefferson would be very dirty politicians if they had to get what they wanted. Now, again, I told you how much they hated Patrick Henry, and they used to pray that God would kill him. When that didn't work, what they did was they were fighting Patrick Henry on another bill, and they said, "We got to get this guy out of our hair." So what they did was they conspired and they got Patrick Henry voted into the governorship of the state of Virginia. And somehow the way the politics worked back then, once he was in as the governor, he wasn't allowed to be involved in the debates in the House, in the state House. And so they got him out of the way so they can get the stuff they wanted done because Henry, you know, God didn't oblige him by killing him, so they voted him into the governorship of the state of Virginia. But Madison also would compromise basic principles in order to achieve the goals he wanted. It's interesting, one time when James Madison was faced with two threats to religious freedom, a bill to establish the Episcopal Church, James Madison hated anything, he hated an established church. There was a bill to establish, there was an Episcopal Church, and there was a bill to levy taxes in support of churches. Something else, and Madison hated both these. But Madison was a politician, and he knew he couldn't, quote, vote against God twice, because he hated the concept of establishing the Episcopal Church, and he hated the idea of paying taxes for churches. So not willing to vote against God twice, Madison voted for the establishment of the Episcopal Church, which he saw as the least threat to religious freedom. That way, by voting for that, he could vote against the bill to levy taxes. So you can go back and you can look and say, well, look, James Madison actually voted to establish a church. Thus, the man who voted to establish a church, when he wrote the First Amendment, there shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, it must not mean what we think it means, because he voted to establish church. You see the point? See the point there? Well, you know, it's ridiculous. Madison ultimately knew that the weight, even by voting to establish the Episcopal Church, eventually there were so many other religions in the state of Virginia that it would all fall apart, in which it did. So the point is, does this vote mean that Madison believed in established churches? Of course not. You know, and then perhaps maybe his support of Bill number 84 should be viewed, you know, in the same way. It was just the lesser of two evils. You know, keep the old nasty Sunday law where you couldn't even, you had to go to worship and so forth. I mean, again, we don't know. The other thing you need to realize, too, is that Madison and Jefferson were what I call them first generation church-state separationists. Again, I want to try to get this point across. We take this stuff for granted. All you have to do is go back and read some history and realize these things that we take for granted were totally alien concepts for much of the history of the world. And Madison, and even though some of these ideas started to float around, John Locke, a British philosopher, started to promulgate some of these ideas. Locke actually, in the 1600s, wrote, pushed for religious freedom for everybody except for Catholics. He said you can't trust them because their allegiance is to the Pope. Jews, I don't know what his thing with Jews were. This, no, you know, they didn't have any rights back then anywhere. Nobody ever really thought about giving them any. And atheists. He didn't think you could give atheists freedoms because you couldn't trust them. Because they didn't believe in God. So that, you know, the idea was if you're an atheist, you've got no moral, you ideally have no morals. Because there's no God that you have to answer to and, you know, you should do your own thing. And, you know, if you want to take that logic, you can argue that logically. I'm not saying I agree with, you know, that all atheists don't have morals, but you can get down and there's a certain amount of logic to that sentiment. So Locke had these ideas. So some of these ideas were floating around. Roger Williams attempted to employ some of this, though we have no real evidence that our founding fathers, Madison and Jefferson, were really influenced by Roger Williams. We don't know. There's a big debate whether Williams influenced John Locke, and then we know no question that John Locke influenced Jefferson. But some argue that that Locke influenced Williams. Nobody knows for sure. Ultimately, though, Locke influenced Thomas Jefferson. But the point I'm trying to make is you had all these lofty ideas floating around in the air, so to speak. And Madison and Jefferson were the first ones to really be able to come along, and not just them, but you know the people that framed the Constitution, to take these ideas out of the air and try to apply them to the real world. You know, and it wasn't an easy transition. I mean, if after 200 years, America's top constitutional scholars and lawyers and historians still battle over the scope, the meaning, and the purpose of the First Amendment, how much perfection should we expect from Madison and Jefferson? You know, more than likely, neither one of them really understood all that was involved in the lofty principles they espoused. I mean, should their exception to the rule then be paraded around as a rule? I mean, both these men, as uncomfortable it is, both these men owned slaves. They railed against the evils of slavery, but they still owned them. Madison eventually sold his. Jefferson couldn't do it. Couldn't do it economically. He couldn't do it as much as he said he hated the institution. You know, should all civil rights laws then be deemed unconstitutional? You know, because these guys own slaves? Of course not. You know, I say it's often like Orville and Wilbur Wright. They invented the airplane, but no one's going to fault them for not understanding how the space shuttle worked. You see the point? See the point I'm trying to make? These guys just started out. And they probably didn't understand all the implications of everything they were doing. And perhaps finally the most important factor behind their support of the Sunday law bill was that Sunday keeping or Sabbath keeping, it wasn't a controversial issue back then. I mean, the main religion there was Protestantism. You had some Catholics. And you had a handful of Jews who didn't have any rights anyway, or very few rights anyway. And the Catholics and Protestants all kept Sunday. There was no problem there. It wasn't a controversial issue back then. These laws aroused little controversy, wrote constitutional scholar Douglas Laycock, and almost no one thought them inconsistent with the constitutional guarantees of religious liberty. And I think the fact was simply because everybody kept Sunday. So it wasn't an issue. It was just tradition. It was history. Everybody knew you kept the Lord's Day. Not enough Sabbath keepers existed, particularly in Virginia, to make Sunday laws an issue. This wasn't an issue. You know, I like to think that had there been vocal Sabbath keepers, and had Sabbath and Sunday been as contentious of an issue in Virginia at that time, say as there was over paying taxes, using tax money to support churches. You know, I like to think that Madison and Jefferson, if they were to stay true to the principles that they espoused, probably would have opposed the type of Sunday law that, under the prevailing conditions, they had supported. You know, I like to think that anyway. But at the same time too, though, the fact remains is, you know, I can sit up here and I can pontificate, I can rationalize, and I can speculate about this until the cows go home. But the uncomfortable historical fact remains that the two architects of religious liberty in America promoted the one thing that Seventh-day Adventists fear the most, and that is a Sunday law. And when almost 200 years later, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court used that historical fact to uphold Sunday laws, we should take heed. History isn't necessarily going to be kind to our positions. And unfortunately, Bill number 84 isn't the only historical constitutional problem that doesn't necessarily bode well for us. Did you know that the Constitution itself, indirectly, but nevertheless very clearly, acknowledges, if not the sanctity of Sunday, at least its historical role as a weekly day of rest? It's right there in the Constitution itself. Article 1, Section 7, deals with the procedure when after Congress passes a bill and sends it to the president for signing. And the president's got to sign the bill or it goes back, you know, however it all works. And it was all laid out back then. And this is the way it reads, talking about when the Congress sends the bill to the president. If any bill shall not be returned by the president within 10 days, Sundays excepted, after it had been presented to him, the same shall be a law. Sundays excepted. Remember, this was back in the 1700s. Sunday back then was nothing but a religious day. This whole idea of the secular Sunday with another 100 years away. Now, this doesn't prove, was the Constitution acknowledging Sunday rest by that? Let me read it again. If any bill shall not be returned by the president within 10 days, Sundays excepted, it shall, after that time, be made law. Now, this doesn't prove the constitutionality of Sunday laws. I'm not saying, well, this proves it, but it's just another fact that doesn't just bode well, you know, for the future in terms of the arguments against, for and against Sunday laws. Now, for the present, though, I mean, the situation is stable. I mean, despite the hype of some of these groups and some of these people and, you know, the National Sunday Law book and all this stuff, despite all that hype, I'm telling you, the Sunday laws or a national Sunday law is a dead issue in Washington, D.C. I mean, there's no more talk about a national Sunday law in Washington, D.C. than there's talk about prohibition, reenacting prohibition. Even the new Christian right, which no doubt would be sympathetic to it, in Pat Robertson's book, The New World Order, Robertson even bemoaned the fact that the only kind of Sunday laws you can have on the books are secular Sunday laws. He bemoaned that. He had a section in the book on the Ten Commandments. And he talked how he took Wednesdays off as a Sabbath or something because he was so busy on Sunday, but he bemoaned the fact that the only Sunday laws that are deemed constitutional are those that are not religious, and he didn't like that. But however much they might want to see Sunday laws, it is not a priority with them. I read their books. I read their literature. I've gone to their meetings. I'm on their mailing lists. And it is right now, it is not an issue with them. The only ones who talk about a national Sunday law at all are Seventh-day Adventists. And the only ones making it appear that it's a legislative priority about to be sprung on us any moment now, while all us Jesuits at the GC hide the fact and hide this truth from the church members, are the offshoots. The offshoots. They're the only ones that are talking about that. You know, at this point right now. Nevertheless, whenever Sunday's laws do return, and I believe they will return, and I believe it can happen very quickly, but I'm just saying right now, it's not an issue. I mean, maybe it will be tomorrow, or maybe a month from now, and we know sooner or later it's going to happen, but as it is right now, it's just not there. And, you know, so when someone sends you a book in the mail or whatever telling you all this, you know, the Sunday law's going on any minute now and all, you know, things are being held back and so forth, you know, by whatever. I mean, ask them to give me any evidence for it because believe me, we follow these things. And believe me, you know, it's funny. We were joking one time, you know, these groups are up there always saying we're hiding it all from the people and so forth. I have absolutely, as a leader in the Religious Liberty Department, I have absolutely no reason to hide any of this from anybody. Hey, when we sometimes struggle with the Liberty campaign and offerings go down some years, we try to think of a campaign theme. We joke. We say, boy, there's nothing that would do us more good than some Sunday legislation. Boy, they would support us, you know? I mean, we have no reason whatsoever to hide any of this from anybody. And I could say for myself right now that I would not do it. I would not hide it from anybody. And I don't believe leadership would hide it from anybody. And if somebody in leadership said hide it, I wouldn't hide it anyway. I would say it anyway. But it's just not true. It's just not true, despite some of the hype that's out there at this point. Nevertheless, whenever Sunday laws do return, the justification, at least for secular Sunday laws, and they've got to start somewhere. I don't know how it's going to come back. I mean, it could be, you know, we know it's going to get stricter and stricter eventually, but how the first Sunday laws will come back, you know, that are part of the final apocalyptic movements, how it'll come back. I know they might start out as secular Sunday laws, but if they start out as secular Sunday laws, they will have constitutional protection. The Supreme Court erased the linchpin argument against Sunday laws, which is that they are religious laws, in a single day in 1961, 15 centuries of Sunday sacredness were just, quote, Sunday sacredness, were just wiped out by the Supreme Court. Now, with the religious element gone, you know, there really are some very good arguments for Sunday laws. As I got into this, and again, I'm just reading you notes from my book, One Nation Under God. I don't know if I tell you I originally had this whole section where I just gave all the arguments for Sunday laws. I'm just going to leave it that way. Because I wanted to make my point. I wanted to convince the readers, boy, there really are some good arguments. You know, you got to see the other side to things. This helps you understand, you know, helps you strengthen your position when you understand the other side. So I had just left that section in the book. Then one morning I was praying, and I just suddenly got overwhelmed with the feeling, that's a mistake. If you leave that in there alone, you know what's going to happen. You know what's going to happen. Some of our dear offshoot brethren, we're going to have a field day with that. I could just see the scandal sheets now. Liberty editor promotes Sunday laws, or Liberty editor for Sunday laws. I mean, I know how these people operate. So I felt convicted and I went back and put in some of the opposing arguments against it. And people said that was probably a good idea. You got to be careful. You leave yourself open, you say the wrong thing, you get in print one time the wrong thing the wrong way, and they will show you no mercy. So, but let's take a minute, let's take for a minute and try to look at some of the arguments for secular Sunday laws. Imagine some guy, somebody comes over, foreign country, say he barely speaks English, got five kids, Roman Catholic, okay? Say he's working at McDonald's. And, he's destitute. And, let's say he's a Roman Catholic and he wants to take Sunday and he wants to go to church on Sunday with his family. His religion is the only thing that gives him strength. No, it's his life. But the boss doesn't want him to go to work on Sunday. He doesn't want him to go to church on Sunday. The boss wants him working there. And the boss says very simply, hey, look, you work on Sunday, and you're fired. And this guy, he can't barely speak English. He's happy to have this job. And he's really in a bind. I mean, doesn't that man have the right to go to work on Sunday? Now, of course, he can get involved. He can hire a lawyer and take it to the EEOC and all that. But he might not even probably doesn't know what the EEOC is. Probably doesn't know what the Constitution says. Doesn't he have a right to go to work on Sunday? To go to church on Sunday? If, however, an across-the-board Sunday law closed everything down right across the board, his right would be protected. John Paul, in his encyclical Centesimus Annus, wrote, "One may ask whether existing laws and the practice of industrialized societies effectively ensure in our own day the exercise to this basic right of Sunday rest." Don't people have a right to go to church on Sunday? Okay. Sunday laws could also help protect these little mom and pop operations against the big chain stores that can afford to stay open 7 days a week. In other words, mom and pop, they bust their chops all week. And then when Sunday comes, they want to rest. They want to go to their Presbyterian church, or they want to go to their Episcopal church, or they want to go to their Mormon church or whatever. But they know that, hey, if they stay closed on Sunday and everybody else is out shopping and the big department store is open, they can lose some crucial business that they really can't afford to lose. And again, a strict Sunday law straight across the board, closing down even the competition as well, would without forfeiting their business to large chain stores that can afford to stay open, would help give, mom and pop the opportunity to rest on Sunday and to go to church. Also, what about, we have zoning laws to protect neighborhoods from the wrong type of shops. I mean, who wants a cement factory or an X-rated bookstore, in their block? And some have argued, too, that the traffic and the noise and the congestion from shopping on Sunday, that if you happen to live near a shopping center and the traffic's going by, that Sunday legislation would provide relief at least one day a week, particularly for the majority of residents who might like to rest on that day. These are some of the arguments for Sunday laws. Then you also, you got laws already exist to protect the family. Medical leave, child custody, pension protection, estate regulations. If freeing employees from Sunday work could help, protect the family as well, isn't that a justifiable reason
for a law.
Now, those of us who keep another day other than Sunday, would argue that these laws discriminate against them. And, well, they do. They do. There's no question about it. But if one day is to be chosen to protect workers, small businesses, families, and neighborhoods, why not pick the day that the vast majority of Americans already acknowledge? You know, suppose some little cult starts up, some little group starts up that's going to keep Tuesdays as their Sabbath day. Should the uniform benefit, to all society? Suppose you got 150 Tuesday keepers in the whole country, and they want to make a Sunday law. Should the uniform benefit for the whole society be taken away because a relatively small number of Americans keep Friday or keep Saturday? Or if, as I said, if some new religion decides to keep Tuesday, should all the benefits from a uniform day of rest be sacrificed to please them? Particularly when nobody is forcing them to go to church on Sunday. We're talking again about a secular Sunday law. We're not talking about anybody forcing you to go to church or forcing you to worship. You know, all this does is put somewhat of a financial burden on you. Should all these benefits be sacrificed for the minority? In this case, must the majority be tyrannized by the minority? The U.S. Supreme Court answered the question in the 1960s, and the answer was no. The benefits from a uniform day of rest, it ruled, firmly outweighed any burdens that legislation might impose upon those who keep another day. Now, I can sit here and give you some of the arguments against, you know, some of these positions, and maybe I ought to. I mean, you know, first of all, no matter how much they dress it in a secular garb, a Sunday law is by its nature a religious law. I mean, one day of rest in seven, that concept itself is a religious concept. No matter how good it might be, it's a religious concept. You know, and add to that that they specifically use Sunday, the day that has traditionally, you know, been deemed by Christians as the day of rest. And I think this argument for it being secular doesn't hold water, you know. And then I think, too, it was very egregious. It was very dishonest of Earl Warren to parallel Sunday clothing laws, remember yesterday I said our laws against murder and stealing going to be thrown out simply because they happen to coincide with a religion? You know, sure, no society is going to exist if you have laws, without laws against killing and stealing, but, you know, society has done very well without Sunday laws. You know what I'm saying? And finally, I've got some other arguments, but I'm not going to deal with it all. If you want to read them, get the book. And finally, the last point, this might be a little complicated for you, but just listen to what I'm saying. Earl Warren's use of Bill number 84 was really very faulty. You know, in a sense, it's what the lawyers say, it proved too much. His own Supreme Court, Earl Warren's own Supreme Court, would have struck down Bill number 84, Jefferson's Sabbath-keeping bill. The Supreme Court would have struck that down because of its overt religious nature. It would have struck that down as a violation of the Establishment Clause. Yet Earl Warren comes along and uses that bill to justify
Sunday laws, but he knows his own court would have struck that down. I mean, Bill number 84 is no more related to a secular Sunday law than the Emancipation Proclamation is related to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And for Earl Warren to use Bill number 84 to justify secular Sunday laws was, to me, in my thinking, is very specious reasoning. Yet the problem is, you know, Earl Warren was the Chief Justice of the United States, and with just four other votes, he could basically do whatever he wants to do, whatever he wanted to do. But then you say, but what about the positive moral environment that people say that closing that Sunday would bring? What about how it would strengthen the family? Where's the evidence of that? You know, maybe I'll hit home here a little bit. Look at our own church. Look at what an utter mess the Adventist home is. You know, and this is with us voluntarily keeping Sunday. You know, I tell people, I say, look, I grew up in a non-religious home. Nobody knew the truth. Nobody knew any of the things, have any of the light that we have. And hey, my family life, growing up as a kid, was so much better than what I see in a majority of Seventh-day Adventist homes today. Even with the Sabbath. Even with the Sabbath. So where's this proof that somehow you're going to keep one day of rest and all that, that's going to make families better? I don't see it. I haven't seen it in Adventism where it was done voluntarily. So you think a law being made is going to somehow suddenly turn everybody into Ozzie and Harriet? Plus, too, American society is radically different than it was, you know, in the, quote, good old days when they had Sunday laws. And Sunday laws might not have the anticipated effect that some of these people want. I mean, in inner cities, for example, where the family structure has been destroyed and unemployment is high, who wants groups of bored teenagers wandering around with nothing to do because everything is closed on Sunday? The bottom line, from my thinking, is that Sunday laws of any stripe violate the principles not only of the Establishment Clause, but the Free Exercise Clause as well, because they make it much more difficult for those who keep another day to practice their religion. But whatever the arguments, for or against, Sunday laws will come back and with a vengeance. As I said, for now, though, the kind of Sunday laws upheld by the Supreme Court are not going to give anybody the mark of the beast. So you got to remember that too. Just, you know, not working, you know, a Sunday law doesn't mean you have the mark of the beast. You know, what Revelation and Spirit of Prophecy warn about, vastly different from, you know, from the typical blue law or from closing down a local beer joint on Sunday. You know, any attempt to enforce worship, which was what the mark of the beast is all about, any attempt to enforce worship would be struck down by the Supreme Court as the Supreme Court now sits. And the way our government now runs, any attempt to enforce what we know is coming now would not work. It would be struck down. You know, Ellen White wasn't describing, you know, the Sunday legislation in McGowan v. Maryland when she wrote, "It will be declared that men are offending God by violation of the Sunday Sabbath, that this sin has brought calamities which will not cease until Sunday observance shall be strictly enforced, and those who present the claims of the, and that those who present the claims of the fourth commandment, thus destroying reverence for Sunday, are troublers of the people, preventing their restoration to temporal prosperity." A long distance exists between what Sunday laws have been for most of American history and what they must become in order for prophecy to be fulfilled. There's a very long distance between them. However, as we know, living in the day and age we live in, long distances can be very, very quickly traversed.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.